This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. The civil war that Palestinians insisted could never happen just has, writes my guest Stephen Erlanger. He's the Jerusalem bureau chief for the New York Times. After forming a unity government, Hamas and Fatah fought for control in Gaza. Hamas won. Erlanger says Gaza now looks like Somalia, broken and ravenous. Israel and the Bush administration are trying to isolate Hamas and Gaza and help Fatah, which is now in charge in the West Bank. We invited Erlanger to talk with us about the divide between Palestinians, how it happened, and what it means for the future of the Middle East. He came to his studio in Jerusalem for our interview, which we recorded this morning. Steve Erlanger, welcome back to Fresh Air. In the profile that you wrote in Sunday's New York Times Magazine, you have a sentence that starts, "There is a madness in Gaza now." What have you seen in Gaza that you haven't seen before?
Gaza's been under a lot of pressure for quite a long time, even before, obviously, Hamas won the election in January 2006. But the pressure has been much higher. And what we've seen is really a civil war in Gaza, a true fight for power between Hamas and Fatah, which has been long dominant in the Palestinian world. And you saw things that Palestinians never used to do to one another. I mean, you saw people being thrown from apartment buildings, patients in hospitals either dragged out or shot in their hospital beds. You saw clerics being murdered. You had kind of assassinations of a kind that you never had, people on their knees, handcuffed, shot in the back of the head. You had a kind of fierceness that was accelerated by a kind of madness, some of it based in religion and some of it simply based in fear. And you had, on the part of Hamas, a feeling that having suffered a crackdown in 1996, at the hands of Fatah and then alive Yasser Arafat, that this was not going to happen to them again. But what you had a lot of people in Gaza shocked, because Palestinians, you know, like to say, you know, we're brothers and you know, we're all about the national project and Palestinians don't kill Palestinians. But of course, part of what we've seen, let's say, in Iraq is we never used to think that Muslims would blow up other Muslims in mosques either, which is a kind of shocking idea, or would fire on a funeral. And there is this kind of sweeping craziness that comes out of a long period of broken nationalism in the Palestinian world, maybe defensive nationalism, a sense that resistance somehow gives life meaning when you're stuck in a place where there are very few jobs and there's not much meaning, where justice hasn't been working, where the law authorities don't work, where the police don't work, where people are thrown back on these pre-modern loyalties, which are the mosque and the family or the clan. And kids with guns feel proud. And then you also have in Gaza an enormously young population. 60% of the population of Gaza is under 19, and 76% is under 30. So you have a lot of free-floating testosterone. You have real political struggle. You have lots and lots of guns. And you have people who feel, certainly on the part of Hamas, that they're acting in the name of Islam. And it's a very potent and fiery and explosive mixture that went up.
Would you say that the civil war, that the actual fighting part is over now that Hamas is in control, is clearly in control of, well, control is maybe the wrong word, but they are the power group now in Gaza?
Yes, I mean, the fighting has stopped, and there is a kind of quiet now. Part of the quiet is built on fear, but people are out at night, and they're in the streets, and there's no more gun firing back and forth. People feel much safer. Ordinary people feel much safer. People who are affiliated with Fatah are afraid, and some of them have been arrested. There have been reports of some people tortured in prison who may have died, at least two people. There are some journalists who feel they're being intimidated by Hamas. Women are nervous, though not much has happened. Christians are nervous, though not much has happened since the first days of the civil strife. It is safer, it's quieter. Hamas is clearly in control, and Hamas sees it as its responsibility to restore stability and law and order. The other day, the political director of Hamas, Khaled Mashal, actually made a kind of apology for things that had happened, mistakes that had taken place. Clearly, Hamas feels some pressure.
What is the split about between Hamas and Fatah? A split that is so acrimonious that it led to this vicious kind of fighting.
Well, Hamas has been around for a very long time. I mean, as the Muslim Brotherhood, it's the Palestinian branch, if you like, of the Muslim Brotherhood, which started in Egypt. It's been around since 1928. It wasn't political, and it wasn't particularly military. But when Fatah turned to negotiations with Israel after the Oslo Accords in the early 90s and began to set up the Palestinian Authority, Hamas objected to Oslo, and it did not take part in the Palestinian Authority. And it began to work in social ways to Islamicize the population. I mean, it really is about bringing Islam to the Palestinians, but it also had a good sideline in fighting Israel. It became very good at suicide bombings and terrorist acts inside Israel, and it began to win more support from people who felt that Oslo and Fatah were not bringing them the state that they had been promised. In fact, Hamas's success pulled Fatah in its direction. Arafat started his own band of thugs, really, the Al-Aqsa Martyrs Brigades, who were an armed militia affiliated with Fatah, who also got very much involved in the fight against Israel, to the point where in 2002 the Israelis reinvaded the West Bank and took it over. They decided not to do that in Gaza because suicide bombings weren't coming from Gaza. Gaza was pretty separated from Israel. Some in Israel wished they had done it then, but they did not. So you have an occupied West Bank, which keeps Hamas under control. But in Gaza, where the Israelis pulled out their troops and settlers 2 years ago, it really opened up the field for Hamas. And the fight is really over the nature of Palestine and what the future is going to be. Fatah is a secular nationalist movement. It came out of the kind of left-wing terror days on the one hand, and Arab nationalism on the other hand. And it is secular. It did finally agree that Israel had a right to exist and supported a two-state solution. But Hamas has a religious orientation, and its charter, which can be quite shocking to read, its charter does not recognize Israel's right to exist. It sees all of British Mandate Palestine as Islamic waqf land given to the Palestinians, to the Arabs, by Allah, and no Muslim is allowed to sell any of it or give any of it away. So the Hamas line has been, we will fight Israel until it disappears, because the land was given to us by Allah. Now, there are others in Hamas who say this is impractical, and we really want to, you know, have a Palestinian state in 1967 boundary lines, and we recognize Israel exists, even though we won't admit it has the right to be there. We recognize the reality of it. But the Palestine that Hamas sees is not at all the Palestine that Fatah sees. And this is really the source of the fight. It's not just politics. It's about ideology and religion and a notion of what actually God would find acceptable.
In Sunday's New York Times Magazine, you profiled Khaled Abu Hilal, who is a former member of Fatah in Gaza, but he's now in Hamas. Why did you profile him? What does he represent in the split between Fatah and Hamas?
Well, Abu Hilal struck me, his journey struck me as Gaza's journey. It was a way to explain how Gaza had started in one place and ended up where it is now in the hands of Hamas. He was born in Gaza of a refugee family and grew up in a refugee camp. And at 16, just before he was 16, he threw a bomb at an Israeli jeep, and he spent the next 11 years in Israeli jails. He was in six of them. He joined Fatah, became radicalized, and when he came out, though he opposed Oslo because he didn't trust Israel, he did go to work for Arafat, but became very disaffected with what he felt were the padded bureaucrats of Fatah who'd given into Israel and into all of the West blandishments and had forgotten their real aim, which was to fight and win an independent Palestinian state. So when Hamas won the elections, he actually went to go to work for Hamas, and he helped them build their parallel police force called the Executive Force, and he was an important part of the Hamas victory in June. He believes that he has left a Fatah that's corrupted, that has lost touch with the Palestinian people, and he thinks Hamas is on the right track.
You asked Hilal how he justifies Palestinians fighting each other. What did he tell you?
Well, he considers it this, you know, they spend a lot of time in prison studying a form of political science, and he's a little self-taught, but in his eyes, this is the necessary price for freedom, that you have a very angry young generation of Palestinians with nowhere to go and nothing to look at, and who are dealing with Israeli incursions and their rage. And he regards their rage and even their sacrifice as a necessary fuel for the revolution in Palestinian thinking that has to come. He, because he comes from Fatah, he believes in a two-state solution, but he believes that Israel will only negotiate a fair solution with a Palestinian movement that it has come to respect with an enemy. I mean, he says you make peace with enemies, not with friends, and they don't respect us. Oslo was the work of traitors. It didn't bring us peace. It brought us subjugation. So he's trying to pull Fatah back to the pre-Oslo days. But of course, for the rest of the world, that was a Fatah that carried out airplane hijackings and murders and killings. He's talking about a fighting Fatah, but it's a fighting Fatah in alliance with Hamas.
But again, how does he justify Palestinians killing each other?
Well, he says it's a great tragedy. It's not that he necessarily justifies it, but he sees it as the inevitable price of an occupied people coming to understand its real interests and its real historical necessities.
What kind of relationship do you have with Hilal? How long have you been talking with him, and how has that helped you, like, understand his position?
Well, I've been talking to him really since about February of 2006, which is just after Hamas won this election and set up its government in Gaza and in the West Bank. And he had gone to work for the tough Hamas interior minister, Siad Siam, and I started to talk to him. Now, he speaks fluent Hebrew, which he learned in prison. And at first, you know, he was a spokesman, and we would talk about what was going on. But as I got to know him better, I realized there was really a brain working there. And I began to think of a profile of him. So I began to spend more time with him and ask him much more searching questions. And then as he became more prominent, it seemed to me that this was someone worth focusing on as a kind of metaphor, really, for what was going on. I mean, I've had seven interviews with him, I think, in the last year or so.
You wrote that Hilal, if he lives, presents the first major internal challenge to the Fatah establishment.
Well, that's true, because he has set up this kind of separate Fatah in Gaza, which he's called Fatah al-Yasser, Fatah named after Yasser Arafat. And it's a breakaway faction. And I said, if he lives, because there are a lot of people who do consider him a quisling and in the pay of Hamas and really want him dead. I mean, well, he says he's still part of Fatah. Fatah says they've excommunicated him. It's always in religious terms. And that he's, you know, left Fatah long ago. But he represents, to me, the first open challenge to Fatah. I mean, most people feel, even in the West Bank, Fatah has lost its way and is almost inevitably going to split in some fashion, certainly generationally, if not ideologically. And this may be the beginning of the real splitting of Fatah.
How difficult is it for you to get to Gaza now to interview Hilal or see what's happening there? What's it like trying to get there now?
Well, it's easier now. They're not shooting each other. So you're not caught in the crossfire. And it's gotten a little easier now because Hamas has stopped firing so many rockets toward Israel. So Israel has stopped retaliating quite so hard from the air. There's a period of wait and see. So the streets are safer. So now you can go. You go from Israel into Gaza. The problem is there's no coordination on either side because the people that used to man the border were Fatah and they all disappeared and Israel won't deal with Hamas. So part of the problem is once you're in Gaza, it's now feels safer because my friend and colleague Alan Johnston was finally released from his extraordinary kidnapped captivity. You're still worried about it. The American consulate that governs Palestine's affairs tells us not to go. It's very dangerous. But we do go. The problem is sometimes coming back because you're walking up to the Erez checkpoint, which Israel keeps a great eye on, and there's nobody really to talk to. I mean, the last time, which was not very long ago, that I came back, you face this big cement wall and this big pipe, and somebody yells at you, go back. And you say, no. And then they say, go back. And then you say, you're a journalist. And they say, go back. So you start making phone calls and finally reach someone who will send someone out to come get you.
You know, you say that Gaza now is more cut off than ever because Hamas is in control and Israel won't recognize the Hamas government. So what does that mean for the people living there?
It's very, very difficult. It's a very important point because the main goods crossing between Israel and Gaza is something called the Karni crossing. And when the Israelis pulled out, everybody said this is going to be the lungs of Gaza, and a lot of money was spent on security. Karni's now been shut since June 12th. There hasn't been a single bit of export out of Gaza since June 12th. The imports coming into Gaza have been really food, medicine, and needed items to keep people alive. No one wants a humanitarian crisis. But the normal economy of Gaza, which is already pretty sick, is dying because factories can't get what they need to produce anything. And when they do produce something, they can't export it. The main people crossing is called Rafah, which is southern Gaza, between Gaza and Egypt, which is sort of monitored by the EU with Israelis looking on cameras. Well, Rafah's been shut since June 9th, so you have about 5,000 Palestinians trying to get back to Gaza who simply cannot. Israel wants them all to come through Israel, through a crossing point inside Israel called Kerem Shalom, but Hamas objects because, frankly, through Rafah, Hamas could bring in money and smuggle in, you know, money and people without the Israelis there. The Israelis would like to stop that. And Karni is a big problem because it's easy for Israel to send in imports. You know, that's not a security problem, but exports are a security problem. And without a Palestinian agreement on the Palestinian side, of a group of people the Israelis can deal with, Carney's going to stay shut. And frankly, Fatah in Ramallah, which is setting up its own government with American and Israeli support in Ramallah, doesn't particularly want Carney open either. It wants to keep the pressure on Hamas. So Mahmoud Abbas, the president of the Palestinian Authority, and Fatah have kind of quietly suggested to the Egyptians and to the Israelis that it's not such a bad thing if Rafah and Carney are kept shut. Let Hamas deal with this victory it got itself in Gaza, which Abbas considers a coup, and suffer the consequences. So the line between that and collective punishment for the people of Gaza is a moral problem that is facing us.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with Stephen Erlanger, Jerusalem Bureau Chief for the New York Times. He's joining us from Jerusalem. We've been talking about the civil war that broke out in Gaza between Hamas and Fatah. Now, instead of a Palestinian coalition government, Hamas is in control in Gaza, and Fatah runs the government in the West Bank. Israel and the United States don't recognize Hamas. The United States considers Hamas a terrorist group. Hamas is officially for the destruction of Israel. So now that Hamas is no longer a part of the government in the West Bank, Israel and the United States are recognizing the government in a way that they didn't before. Money is being released to the government that had been withheld. What are other ways that Israel and the United States are dealing with this new government in the West Bank differently than they had dealt with the Fatah Hamas coalition government?
Well, it's probably not a good metaphor in the Middle East to use a pig, but in a way they're kind of trying to make a silk purse out of a sow's ear. The capture of Gaza by Hamas was a disaster for American and Israeli policy. It bifurcates the Palestinian world. Bush wanted a Palestinian state in place by the end of his term. Well, that state is now in two parts, and the United States and Israel are clearly supporting one of them. They hope to make the West Bank a model to pour in aid, to help Salam Fayyad and Abbas create functioning institutions, to help them create the kind of thing Hamas promised when it won the election, which was change, reform, security, stability in the West Bank. Part of what Tony Blair is supposed to do, he's the new diplomatic representative of the quartet, which is the United States, the European Union, the United Nations, and Russia. Part of his job is to help the Palestinians, i.e., the West Bank, non-Hamas Palestinians, to build these institutions and prepare themselves for statehood down the road. But part of it is also to make the West Bank into such a garden that Gaza will somehow, you know, want to join despite Hamas, or
this is
maybe
like the people of Gaza you're talking about, because Hamas certainly isn't going to say, well, we'd better just do everything Fatah is doing. So the hope is that the people in Gaza would say, we want some of what they've got, so therefore we don't want the Hamas government anymore.
Well, that's precisely right, and that's one reason why they're keeping so much pressure on Hamas by keeping the crossing shut. I mean, if you can't have a normal economic life in Gaza, if you can't export fruits and vegetables, if people can't work, it's not going to be a very attractive place to live, and the idea is people will blame that on Hamas. Now, Hamas is already kind of making gestures toward reconciliation with Fatah and wants to talk again about a unity government and going back more toward status quo ante. But Mahmoud Abbas, for the moment, though he had decided to have a unity government with them only a few months ago, has said, you know, these people, I can't work with them. He's actually called them a murderous gang of terrorists, which is shocking and interesting language from any Palestinian about other Palestinians, let alone from the Palestinian president. So for the moment, he has set his face against Hamas. He seems to have listened to the Americans and the Israelis who say to him, Hamas is your enemy, not your friend. You can't work with them. You can't deal with them. And he is being helped, though he is he's considered a weak leader, to try to create something better for the people of the West Bank.
Now, if I understand correctly, part of what President Bush is trying to do now is to define the Palestinians as the Fatah-led, Palestinians. But at the same time, Saudi Arabia, for instance, wants Fatah and Hamas to come together again so that the Palestinians are unified. So are the Saudi interests and President Bush's vision at odds right now?
Well, yes, they are. I mean, and one of the reasons is that the Saudis believe that Hamas represents a significant portion of the Palestinian population. We can argue it could be 25%, it could be 30%. On election day, it was 44%, which is enough to give them a win. The feeling is you can't divide the Palestinians. There can't be a consensus. You certainly can't negotiate a peace with Israel if you leave out a significant portion of the Palestinian people. And that was Mahmoud Abbas's idea also when he wanted to bring Hamas into politics in the first place. Mr. Bush, whose speech seemed to have a kind of element of desperation to it, presented Palestinian politics as this stark choice between a kind of evil Hamas that, you know, wants to rule everything by force and won't ever recognize Israel, and Fatah, which is somehow good. But the people of Palestine voted against Fatah because it was hardly spotless and they were sick of their corruption and the way they'd mismanaged things. If there were an election tomorrow, Fatah might actually win it, but there isn't an election tomorrow. And what one may have is a period of awkward confrontation, a split Palestinian world, and a Gaza that sinks farther and farther into a kind of isolated desperation. I was very struck on Bush's speech. He talked about how Jordan and Egypt should do more to help the Palestinians in the West Bank and Gaza and open up their borders to trade. But of course, it is exactly the Egyptian border with Gaza right now that's completely shut.
Is it possible to have a genuine peace negotiation, which would be the ultimate goal, I imagine, of the direction the president wants to head in, if half of the Palestinians are shut out because Gaza would not be included because Gaza is run by Hamas?
Well, I think it would be hard to do for that reason, but also because Mahmoud Abbas is himself not a strong figure. He's not terribly well respected now inside Fatah. I mean, he is the elected president of all the Palestinians. He believes in nonviolence. He wants to negotiate a peace with Israel. But Israel, right now, I think the Americans agree with this, frankly. Israel believes that what Arafat couldn't say yes to, Abbas, a much weaker figure, can't say yes to, and that negotiations could get to the point where they would fall apart very quickly over the main issues of refugees and Jerusalem and could throw people back into another violent period of intifada. In other words, the Israeli concern is negotiations that are bound to fail with a people which is at war with itself. I mean, how can you make peace with a people who's at war with itself? Could be riskier than not going into negotiations. So what Bush and the Israelis seem to have in mind, which is a ratcheting back of expectations, is a period where the Palestinians think about this crisis that has come upon themselves and this civil war they've had. Bush called it a moment of clarity, and to some degree this is precisely right. Let the Palestinians decide the future they want. Bush's idea is the West can help them decide by making moderation attractive. And when the Palestinians have made the right choices then and created effective institutions, then they'll be ready for statehood.
Do you think that in some ways the Palestinians will be seen as having compromised whatever power they have in peace negotiations because of not only the lack of unity that they've shown, but the brutal fighting against each other that happened in Gaza.
Well, Palestinians are in despair about what they've watched themselves do to themselves. And there are a lot of Arab countries who are in despair about it, too. The Saudi foreign minister was quoted one day recently as saying that the Palestinians had just about put the last nail into their own coffin. There's a lot of fatigue. The Palestinians, everyone wants them to have a state. The real question is of what size and will it be responsible? And you can, you know, justice and fairness and history aren't necessarily decisive in what happens. But everyone believes, even if they don't care about the Palestinians themselves, that the struggle between Israel and Palestine poisons the atmosphere of the Middle East, and it gives the extremists and the radical Islamists that the United States is trying to battle in different places more justification for the fight. And the Sunni Arab states feel they're on the wrong end of history, and they're very nervous about it. Jordan's fragile. Mubarak in Egypt is old. He's trying to get his son into place, it seems. There's a lot at stake here. It's not just about oil. It really is about the future of secular, moderate governments throughout the Middle East.
What are Israel's security concerns now with a Hamas-led government on its border in Gaza?
Well, I think Israel is still more obsessed with Iran than any other topic. And lately, it is also quite worried about Syria, you know, whether the Syrian discussion of war or peace is going to lead to anything. The Palestinians are a big problem, but they're not an existential problem in the same way. Even Hamas in Gaza, its weapons are still quite primitive. Israel, there are people in Israel, there are always people in Israel who think it would be a good idea to go into Gaza in a serious way and whack back Hamas power, if only to make it harder for them to fire rockets into Israel or to make Mahmoud Abbas's life easier on the West Bank. There are other people in Israel who say that's counterproductive, it would be too expensive, it would cost too many lives, and then what do we do on the fourth day? No one in Israel wants to retake Gaza and keep it.
This month marks the first anniversary of the start of the war between Israel and Hezbollah. And that war really shook up Israeli politics because it was seen as a strategic failure in many ways. Could you just give us an overview of what you see happening in Israeli politics now?
Yeah, the mood is really bad. I think it's worse than it probably needs to be. But the war was seen as a military disaster, though not really that bad a defeat, but a political nightmare. It's destroyed the political future of this government. It may have destroyed the political future of the new party, Kadima, which Ariel Sharon built out of the remnants of Likud and parts of Labor. The great third way, I think, is falling apart. If there were elections today, Likud on the right would win it, and Kadima would probably come in a poor third place next to Labor. So it will have, in the future, big meaning too. And you have a government here that's functioning, but it doesn't seem to have much of an agenda. It has very little popular support. Nobody's quite sure how to replace it or with what. And what the army is doing is very busily looking at its mistakes. The Air Force acquitted itself pretty well, but in terms of military intelligence and in terms of ground forces and how the army deals with rocket fire, there's an enormous amount of self-searching. The advantage of Israel as an open democracy, which is very self-critical, is that this is the kind of process that goes on at a high level and a high decibel level. and they will, I think, fix most of their problems. But it was quite a shock last summer.
Let me get to Al-Qaeda for a second. The National Intelligence Estimate was released this week, and it reports that Al-Qaeda's leadership has reconstituted and Al-Qaeda has re-strengthened itself and is determined to attack inside America's borders. How are you interpreting that? Like, how does that read from where you are?
Well, it reads that the cost of the war in Iraq is still being counted and you can't see the end of the page. That's what it feels like here. I think that's what a lot of Israelis feel about it also. It has made the Middle East a more dangerous and fragile place. And certainly the Israelis are very worried if the Americans pull out of Iraq too quickly, if Western powers seem to have been defeated in Iraq by global jihadism, it's going to be difficult to restrain global jihadism. And this is the feeling of Egypt and Jordan and the Gulfies and many moderate Arab states, even if they don't want to say so aloud. It's not such a problem in Palestine, partly because Hamas is not very interested in Al-Qaeda. It has worked to keep Al-Qaeda out of the Palestinian territories. Hamas has a sort of nationalist focus. It's interested in Palestine. It's not terribly interested in this larger Al-Qaeda agenda of Westerners out of the Middle East. Hamas keeps saying our issue is with Israel and the state of Palestine. It's not with Americans, it's not with Jews, it's not with anybody else. And you can believe them or not, but that's what they say.
With journalists being targets for murder and for kidnapping around the Middle East now, what are some of the precautions you have to take? You told us a little bit more about how it's been, you know, how particularly during the fighting it was very difficult to get into Gaza. But what, in general, what kind of precautions do you have to take now when you're reporting?
Well, you know, we have bulletproof jackets and helmets. I try to wear them as little as possible because I think they make you conspicuous rather than, I mean, they sort of make you into a target. There are too many people who sort of want to shoot at you and see what happens. I think it's easier for me as a print journalist to try to be inconspicuous. I travel, as I said, with Palestinians, and I sometimes will ask a third Palestinian, in addition to the driver, to come and just watch the crowd while I'm working. So if I'm working with one translator, I keep the driver in the car, and I have a third person listening to the crowd to see if anything sounds wrong. And once in a while, that person has said to me, let's go, it's time to go. And off we go. I just end what I'm doing. I try not to advertise where I'm going. I don't make appointments very far in advance. But, you know, and this is really a Gaza issue, but it's not Iraq. It's not as dangerous as that. There aren't really people out to kill us. And I hope now in Gaza there are people who don't any longer feel it's useful to kidnap us.
Well, Stephen Erlanger, I want to thank you very much for talking with us. And, be well and thank you.
Thanks, Terry.
Stephen Erlanger is the Jerusalem bureau chief for the New York Times. He spoke to us from Jerusalem. Our interview was recorded this morning.